Welcome to a new episode of Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history, each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is Ian Fletcher. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thanks for having me, Siskoid.
I always ask, what did you think of this? We won't reveal right away what the one panel is, but that idea of just looking at just the one discrete unit of comic book storytelling.
When I was going through the tentacle game of everything on the Fire and Water Network and going, I like that show. What else does that person do? And I got to this one and read the concept. I went, what? And I figured, what the heck? I'll listen to it. And at the end of it, I loved it. This is the strangest concept I've come across for a podcast, but it works. It is the most engaging listening I ever expected to find over interpreting a single piece of a panel in a comic book.
In some way, that's what I aim to do with all my shows. They're all the show you didn't think you wanted to listen to. Which isn't great marketing, but
I think that privately, everyone who listens to the show at the end of the show goes, I could do with more of that. And then looks at a comic and really pays attention to panels. And that's what I find after I listen to an episode is I will pick up whatever comic I happen to be in the middle of. And for a while, I am very studiously paying attention to the panels because before that, of course, I'll just go through it a little quickly and at a high level and won't necessarily pay attention to all the small details. And then after this, I feel like a monocle has appeared over my eye and now I'm seriously critiquing each panel as I go.
I agree that there is some of that when you read comics, that sometimes you're so focused on the words that some of the art kind of falls away in a way. Whenever I do like full comic book issues on FW Team Up, for example, it will very often happen that while you're dissecting the comic for the show, you know, somebody will have a question about, is this logical? Then we look at the page and, oh no, there it is. You know, there's the visual cue. Not everything is told in words.
Yeah.
So you really need to look at each panel, at the page, at everything. So yes, this show sort of trains us to do that. All right, so let's pick a panel. Our randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. Prior to the recording, we did roll up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally, a panel. And in this case, we rolled the year 1960, the month of January. Among all the comics out that month, the revolving finger falls on Tintin in Tibet by Hergé. The graphic album came out in 1960, but was first serialized in Tintin magazine, the final chapter dropping the first week of January of that year, which is how it's been archived in my collection. Even though the English language wiki says 1961, I'm not going to trust it. I'm going to trust the French wiki on this one. Page 29 of 62 and panel 9 of 17. There's a lot of stuff on these pages, folks. And you'll find not only the panel, but the sequence and then the page in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. All right. So, Ian, apparently it took 25 episodes and 25 tries with the randomizer to get into one of my French language comics albums. Are you a Tintin fan? I mean, I'm always curious about how widespread these classic Euro comics were in elsewhere in the world, so in English Canada, in your case.
I am definitely a Tintin fan. And when I was in primary school, and I think even junior high had a perfect bound collection, these were incredibly popular. If you went to the library, because you went to the library like once or twice a week to get a book, and these ones were always being checked out. And usually read, and this is something I love about comics like this, usually read together with people. You know, a friend, you wouldn't just grab it and then sit down on your own and read it. You and a friend would sit and read the comic together, not like sounding it out, but both looking at the page and both going through it and both appreciating it. I vividly remember that. I did an informal panel of people in my house and friends, colleagues at work, and it's very hit or miss for familiarity with Tintin. Oh. Anybody kind of born not in the 70s and 80s, maybe closer to the 90s. The only reason they know Tintin is maybe because of the movie in the, I think it was what, the 2000s? Mm-hmm. The animated movie, or the computer animated movie, as it were.
And maybe even the cartoon for some.
Yeah, the cartoon. Yeah, some.
Yeah.
Although I never saw the cartoon on television because if I had, I would have voraciously consumed it. But a lot of people have not heard of this at all. They didn't know Tintin from a hole in the wall, and everyone else went Tintin, and then usually went Snowy because that was the favorite character out of Tintin. I heard that there's other people in this book other than a certain dog.
Well, I mean, for French Canadians, and I imagine for the French-speaking world in general, Tintin is ubiquitous. For me, it was the first comic I ever had in my hands, and it wasn't one of the comprehensible ones. It was like one of the later ones that was full of Coke and Stock, which is full of characters that are coming back to the series. Tintin goes back to the Middle East, and then there's like, since he's had, a number of adventures there, all of these characters are showing up again. It's full of continuity. I was 3 years old and learning to read at that time, so I took that book everywhere with me. But I don't know what I made of it because it's a very complex story about human trafficking, and I mean it's very adult. But it was my first whatever. It's the first one they put into my hands. But I had an uncle who had the whole collection. He
Oh,
had
wow.
all of the Tintins, which I do now. Except for one, which I apparently lent out and is missing from my collection. It's been missing for a few years, and no one has fessed up to it. I don't know.
You just need to subtly mention it and then, maybe cough Christmas afterwards or something and get somebody to send it in to you.
Yeah, I don't know what to do about this, but the broken ear is the one that's missing.
Christmas.
Christmas. So and there's that, and there's like, you had all the Asterix and so on. And the ones I didn't have, of course, I read from the library. You say when you go out to the library to get one book, I was doing 10 books. Every trip was 10 books. After I graduated from the comics, from bande dessinée, from those graphic albums, which there was plenty of in the French-speaking world, that's how comics are mostly consumed. Then I got into, what we'd call today young adult books for younger readers. And there was still 10 at a go, I was a voracious reader. And eventually I did get the albums that I was missing for my collection of Tintin. I mean, what strikes me about Tintin generally is how the first books come out in the late 1920s
It's amazing.
and on through the 60s. And it's like the draftsmanship, especially, I know some of the books were redrawn, so you can tell when a book was not redrawn, which has like an earlier, softer, rounder style, and then later when Hergé is using a studio, they're doing a lot of the backgrounds, all those mountains, a lot of that is almost, it's not photoreal, but it's got like a draftsmanship that is high quality. But these books are extremely high quality in comparison to a lot of American, let's call it floppies.
Yeah.
It's a book, it's well bound, there are giant pages. And also, like, the art was so, for that era, for something that was coming out in the 40s and 50s, there's almost no comparison in terms of the draftsmanship there. So I don't know, how do you compare the various traditions?
It's funny because I remember when I looked at these books, and you mentioned Asterix, and very similar, because they are both in that very overlarge, like coffee table size. They're not the size of a standard comic book. They're very big, very, tall, which meant that you could fit all of the panels on the page without shrinking them to the point that you couldn't read the writing. Because Tintin also has, it's very text heavy for a quote comic book. So I think if we wanted to be just a tad snobbish, is Tintin is an example of these weren't really like the funnies. These were more illustrated adventures done in sequential panel format, if you want to maybe make that distinction. And I think it deserves it because incredibly complex plots. Frankly, as a kid, I didn't get half of it. I was just like, Tintin's going to the moon. The Hardy Boys never did that. Tintin's on, a steaming ship, and he's got this sailor who's always got little bubbles above him, and I don't really know what that means, but I like that he's angry, kind of like Donald Duck. There's all these adult themes, but as a kid, I read all of it. I didn't quite comprehend it, but I could see the same characters being used. I could even get that there is some kind of continuity going on, and my childhood passion outside of, what few comic books I could get access to was Hardy Boys. I read dozens of Hardy Boy stories, and when I got to Tintin, the Hardy Boy stories basically got shelved because Tintin was far more interesting. He had the dog, that was a big bonus. But it also helped that there is the right blend in Tintin comics of comedy, but it also was drawn more realistically. You look at Asterix, and everybody has very exaggerated features. And I love Asterix, so I'm not knocking it. I think everyone likes Asterix. But it was very much more cartoony. It reminded me of what you'd see in Disney comics. You know, very exaggerated features, you know, cartoony, bubbly. You look at Tintin, and you go, well, this is a stylized illustration. And I don't know what that activated me as a youngster was just I was looking at Tintin with sort of elevated expectations that usually were delivered. I can't remember specifically a very bad Tintin magazine. They were always top notch. But I think because they were more advanced, I don't remember the plot of almost any Tintin. You know, and I'm looking to start acquiring them now. And I have been for a while. I've been keeping my eye out in used bookstores. And I've just kind of bit the bullet and said, I'm just going to start buying one a month, you know, and get them new. Because I love these. Whenever I pick up and read a Tintin, when I can find access to it, I read the thing cover to cover. And at the end of it, I go, this is amazing. I can't believe how well put together the story is and how much character actually bleeds off the pages onto this. You know, and really, if you look at it, there's three main characters. And the three main characters, you could kind of summarize their characters on an index card. They're not that deep. But without them, the stories wouldn't work. And I don't know. I don't know how I can gush over Tintin anymore. I love Tintin.
I even read some of them in English, you know, at the library when I was done with all the, because this is those big hardbacks. Yeah. That's just the format. You know, everything is in that format. And I know they were stripped in a magazine with a lot of different stories, a little bit like what manga does. Mm-hmm. You know, a bunch of stories. And those magazines were also available in some way. And by that point, they were reprinting Tintin or Asterix. You know, they were just reprinting them in I don't know, 4 to 8 pages or something, because obviously these books were out, you know, they'd been out since, in this case, the 60s. When you look at them in the magazines, it's not that they're smaller. It's that the pages are built differently. So yeah. Whatever's on the page, like everything in those albums, Hergé took the time to repaste them up. Always wants to end on, you know, every page has to end on a little shock moment, a little reason to turn the page. And this is one of the things that he personally developed. When you're repasting them on a larger page, sometimes, you know, it doesn't end on the right moment. And mm-hmm. he would create new illustrations, new panels to inject into the books to make it so that when you get to the bottom of the page, you've got your page turner moment there.
I did not know that. That is, man, my love for this man is just growing.
We're going to get into the panel soon. I promise. But
the show is indeed about a panel, by the way.
It is about a panel of this. But one of the things that really opened my eyes at an adult age, because obviously I'd been living with this since I was a kid, I found a book in the university library, like a critical look at Tintin and the different albums. And reading that really opened my eyes to the craftsmanship and the way that he was evolving as a writer over the decades. So at first, you know, it goes to a country. He does, it's almost like one-page gags to a point, because it was, you know, the original stories were in a newspaper for the youth. That's how Tintin starts. But eventually, yes, the plots get, you know, like big pulpy detective stories, action detective stories, and they get more complicated. By the end, they become very experimental. It's a little bit like what Shakespeare was. Well, it's a little bit like Shakespeare.
Tintin is like Shakespeare, quote, Siskoid.
In the sense that when Shakespeare, you know, like he did all the big ones, and then he started, I think he got bored, and he started experimenting with the form. And a lot of this later plays are very experimental, are things that were never put on stage, but we have them. But they were never staged at the time because they were too weird, did not respect any kind of genre conventions that he was supposed to be adhering to back in the Elizabethan era. Well, Tintin is kind of like that. The last few albums are experimental. They do away with a lot of the genre tropes, or they fool around with them. The thing with the page turner, well, in The Jewels of the Castafiore, there's always a page turner. There's a big mystery. The jewels have disappeared. There's each page turner is a red herring. Each page turner is a fake. You turn the page and it's like, haha, made you turn the page. Like he weaponizes that thing that he's always been doing, he weaponizes it to make a story without a villain. a story that tells you there's a mystery and there's no mystery.
Interesting.
And the one after that, it's all the big villains that come back, but they're basically the Three Stooges in this.
I recall that.
It's just to make fun of them. So towards the end, there's some like very interesting things happening because he's, in a way, he's bored. In a way, he wants to do something else. He's feeling some sort of anxiety, artistic anxiety, and it shows in the work. So when you reread this stuff with adult eyes, yeah, it starts to take on something. There's something interesting in there that you would never have seen as a kid.
And I think that speaks to Hergé. And to be clear, I was desperately hoping you were going to say his name first so I know how not to say Hergé or something, which is what I said as a youth. I just had to think of Hercule Poirot or something.
Well, his real name is Georges Rémy, initials GR or JR, flip it, French it, you know, Hergé. That's how he got his pen name.
I will nod along as if that I followed that in any way. I think Hergé has always shown a little bit of interaction with the audience. And I don't mean in that like an author can get nowadays. I don't think he would have got anything like that in the era he was writing. But you felt him bleeding through. And I knew nothing about him. And I've started looking into him more, especially when this panel was shot over to me. I started looking into him more and just started discovering so much about the man that I didn't know. But it reminded me of when I would look at my grandfather's artwork, because my grandfather was an artist. And when my grandfather would draw, whether it be a cityscape, that was his favorite, was putting cityscapes with churches. He loved doing that. Or at times he liked drawing cats. If that was drawn by a different human being, same place, same person, and they even tried to imitate my grandfather's style, it wouldn't end up the same, because I would see bits of my grandfather come through. Now, of course, part of that is because I knew him. But that's what I feel about Tintin. As I was reading it, a lot of like bits of emotion would come through in some of these panels, in some of the characters, in the way it was drawn, in the way it was an action scene when it's framed. It felt to me, and I wasn't really conscious of this until I started looking at it later, but it felt to me like he knew he was writing for children, but he had tremendous respect for giving them something solid to look at. And if you compare this with some of the other works of the era aimed at children, they're like, whatever. As long as they throw the dime on the counter and walk home with the mag, I'm happy. But here, there's craft and love and whimsy often thrown in, and it literally shines off the page in places. And that is stupendous.
I think you're right that there's a solidity to the work. There's something about the line work and the like, the thickness of the line that makes his figures particularly solid.
Yeah.
Almost like they're, I don't know, sometimes I look at some Tintin books and I feel like, especially the later ones, and I feel like it's sort of an animation cell art. The figure is, it could pop out of the page. You could move it around that landscape, you know? Okay, this is already the length of a normal episode at this point. So this is a panel taken from Tintin in Tibet. So let's put it in context of what we've been talking about. This is book 20, and it is a sequel, a late coming sequel to The Blue Lotus, which is book 4. So in that story, Tintin makes friends with a Chinese boy called Chang. And in this one, Tintin has nightmares about Chang and decides to go look for him in the Himalayas, where Chang's plane is supposed to have crashed. And so this apparently is Hergé's most personal book. That's what critics say about it. Tintin's anxiety is really the writer, artist's dealing with his own depression at the time. And by his accounts, it's the book he's most proud of. So the last few books I said were experimental. This is part of that sequence, because unlike everything that we've seen before, there are no villains, there are no guns. The pulp mystery thriller stuff is just absent. It's more spiritual. It's about Tintin going up a mountain, So it's at the start of that sequence. So it heralds that postmodern deconstructionism that will follow. I mean, I think we've shown that we could do a whole podcast just about that.
You could do a whole podcast about Tintin in general, I think.
I think it would be possible for sure, because there's a lot to it. But let's bring it down to the one panel. And it's not a big panel. It's a very small panel, which I will let you describe.
Okay, so I'm going to describe this two ways, because this episode isn't long enough already. The first way is for somebody who maybe has never seen Tintin in their life. Like some of those queried colleagues and coworkers who went, Tintin? I don't know what a Tintin is. So we've got a rectangular panel. In it is some suggested furry creature that could be a dog, but it looks like it has wings for ears. It's grappling on a what appears to be a cloudscape because there's billowy tufts of pure white underneath it. And in fact, there are only three colors on this panel. There is black, there is white, and then there are varied hues of a kind of fleshy. And the creature is attacking some kind of what it looks like a kidney that he is grappling down on, while above him are the letters G-R-R-R. And they are done in sort of this fuzzy caterpillar font that appears to be emanating upwards from the creature while it wags its tail. You can suggest that this creature is definitely a dog, except it has a slightly sinister kind of twirl to its eyebrow and just beady little eyes. This could be, in fact, the villain of our piece, attacking somebody's torn remains laying on the clouds. Now, if you've ever seen a Tintin comic, you have Snowy, who is clearly in some kind of white field, maybe clouds, maybe snow, maybe a room full of cotton. And he is grappling something that, and I'm not being a little silly, it actually took me a moment when I looked at this panel to realize that this appears to be a chicken that he's after. And it's only because the chicken's kind of upside down. Like, you know, when you take a chicken out of the package and you look at it on the top and you go, yeah, that looks like a chicken. It's got the back and the breasts and then it's got the legs on either side. And then you flip it over and it looks like this awful flesh thing. Well, that's kind of the view we have, but a little bit on the side. And he is attacking the chicken ferociously. And you're going to guess by the wag of his tail that he's either trying to grapple this chicken because it's trying to roll away from him, or perhaps he's just stolen the chicken and he's trying to tear into it before somebody can scold him and make it put it back. But there appears to be a little bit of mischief coming from the panel because the grr above has a playful kind of look to it.
Two good jobs. I will take you to task about the colors because I quite enjoy the soft powder blue that's under Snowy to create a shadow. Essentially, under his body, because he's in that position that is like a cat stretching. You know, the front legs and the head are really low, but the back end is kind of higher.
Yeah,
so that creates a space under him. We kind of see the other back paw there, just under his belly, and so there's a little blue there.
I agree that it is blue, but only when I've looked at other panels around it. When I looked at this panel in isolation, I only saw a kind of gray tone. Like, you know, that very, very soft gray tone that almost starts bordering on blue? That's the way I saw it. Because I tried to look at this without looking at the comic at all first, before, you know, just to get that pure first impression. And that's where I got the idea. And I went, he looks like he's on clouds. Because I don't know, the blue just struck me as gray. But as soon as you see the panels around it, it's inescapably blue.
Right. When there's enough blue on the page, now it's blue.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like it's one of those tricks on your eyes that, you know, you can interpret a color different ways depending on the other colors you can see in the environment.
This is very much a white on white thing because, you know, the dog is white, the snow is white. So really, you've got that chicken.
And there's no horizon line. So what we're looking at, there's no background in a way. If you look above Snowy, Snowy basically takes up the bottom half of the panel is Snowy with his legs up over this chicken, grappling it. And then the top right has the tail wagging, which clever of Hergé, that's where your eye is going to be drawn. You sort of look at it and then you say, oh, his tail's wagging. He's happy. In the top left, it is utterly blank except for the grr coming out and the little action lines coming out from Snowy. And the very top left of the panel, a significant chunk, not like is a little bit, but a significant chunk is just blank with just a ghost, an absolute ghost of shading, almost like it's bleeding over from another panel.
Mm.
It's very stark, and it almost feels a little pop artish looked at in exclusion like this.
Yeah, and it does use the comic book grammar, which is to say, lines that are absolutely abstract, that represent movement. Not only movement, because Elche is also very good at using lines to represent emotion.
Yeah.
So these are lines that do not exist in the real world, but that the comic book reader can understand to be movement or emotion. So in the movement area, there is one line, one little curve that seems to say the chicken is being jostled, and then the wagging tail. And you could also argue that the wagging tail is representing emotion, but in this case, the lines really are movement. And then there's these angry squiggles that come out of his head.
I would call those like Charlie Brown annoyance lines is what I always think of those
as. Charles Schutz, also very good with an economy of line, telling a story. So this is telling us that I want to keep calling him Milou because that's his name in French. That's his real name.
Milou,
which is just a dog name. It means nothing. Whereas Snowy, there's an extra joke here because he's Snowy in the snow. There's a visual joke for English readers, but that doesn't exist for French readers. But in any case, Milou is both, he's happy to have the chicken, but also he's having a tough time with it and he's a little frustrated. I think that's what those lines are saying, those squiggles. There's this frustration.
Yeah, I mean, if I didn't know better, I'd say the chicken was trying to escape from him and he was trying to pin it down and keep it in place. The body language on Snowy, I mean, I'm a dog person. I have dogs. I have a dog. And this is dog body behavior. I have seen my poodle doing this stuff when he's going after something and like either playing with it on the ground or he's got a very large piece of food that he's, you know, grappling, you know, using his paws to pin it down while he puts the mouth down, but the tail's up, ready to spring forward in case it moves again and ready for him to try to sort of shuffle it around with his paws. Like this, I was joking a bit in the first one that you would mistake this as something else, but this is a dog. And this looks so much like a dog it's really hard with the minimalism of lines. Like a lot of Snowy's lines don't even connect. You know, if you used a paint, you know, a bucket tool on this and tried to put any color on Snowy, the entire panel would be washed out with that color because there's several points where he's not, you know, the lines just don't quite connect. But you understand, you know, what this creature is looking at it from head to toe immediately. Not only it's a dog, you can start to even guess breed. If this is your first ever panel you'd ever seen Snowy on, I'm still having an existential crisis. He's named something different in French. That'll take a while for
most
the shock
of the
to
characters have a different name except for Tintin.
That's it. You're destroying my reality.
Well, because the jokes don't work. A lot of the characters have a pun in their names.
Oh, I see.
And so that doesn't work in French. In French, they had a different pun.
Yep. Okay, it's a different pun.
To jump on what you're saying, I love how he's bracing as well. He's in snow. This chicken is elusive, so his back legs are very much bracing. It's almost like he's dug a little corner in the snow to keep this chicken from slipping away, because obviously it's in snow, so it's a frozen chicken. The chicken is well frozen, as we'll find out if we, you know, look outside to the larger sequence. It's a frozen chicken. But yet, I have such respect for artists who are able to do pets well. Dogs, yes. Cats, for me, I'm a cat person. So when cats are acting like cats, even with a minimalist, very cartoony style, if the cat is acting like a cat, if the cat has a body language like a cat, if the cat is built like a cat, some people have difficulty just drawing an animal to make it look like it really would. And most readers have one of those, either one or both, like sitting there. You know, you've got your reference and you're going, well, that's not a very well-rendered dog or cat, you know. And I think Snowy is always very well rendered, and you're right, it's minimalist. He's usually a contour. There's no texture inside him. You can tell he's furry.
He's like the opposite of X-Men's solid black economy-saving costume. You know, he's just white with an outline. Like his fur, aside from the borders of Snowy, there's no detail inside the body on Snowy at all. It's only where the light would touch the edge is inked in black.
Right. In a very fuzzy style.
Yeah.
So you always get that he is fuzzy. Can you guess at the breed?
That's a loaded question because I'm actively petitioning my wife for us to get one of these breeds, as I've wanted a Snowy, that's his name, since I was a little kid. I've wanted a Snowy. I found out that this particular terrier breed is actually rapidly going extinct.
Oh.
This used to be a very popular breed that I believe it's the Wirehair Terrier. And I was doing some research because I've started the long game. When we get our second dog, what is it going to be? And while looking into them, this used to be in the early 1900s. So in the era that these magazines were originally being penned, this was a very popular breed. Won a lot of shows, you know, especially in Northern Europe. And nowadays, the active population of this breed has apparently shrunk to the point where without some kind of drastic intervention, the breed will just vanish. There's not enough people interested in owning it and therefore breeding it.
Wow.
So there's your piece of dismal news for the day.
According to the internet, you know, he's supposed to be modeled after a fox terrier.
Fox terrier, yes.
Who was always at this cafe that Hergé used to go to. He was named Milou, which was Hergé's girlfriend's nickname at the time. So that came from that. And I've heard girls being called or referenced as Milou. Probably Mylène was the actual name. I don't know about that. But yeah, and Milou, Snowy for you. You know, Snowy is a very interesting character because at this point, he's very much a dog. But when he started out, Tintin didn't have a sidekick. He didn't have Captain Haddock there. Not until, I think, book 7 or something like that. So the dog could hear him, understand him. The dog spoke, and Tintin would respond.
So this is a proto-Garfield we're looking at.
Snowy used to be able to communicate with humans. And as more humans got into the cast, and Tintin had other people to bounce off of, the dog would still speak, but he's speaking to us. He's the fourth wall breaker. He's, you know, like the reader can understand what he's saying, and Tintin does not respond. And when Tintin is around, it more usually barking or growling, or, you know, his behavior becomes less human as Tintin makes more human friends. Isn't that the way?
So what we're discovering here is that Tintin, once accompanied by his childhood fairy guardian, gradually starts losing his innocence and kind of Narnia-esque begins forgetting his connection to this obviously mythical and wonderful creature who still follows him around affectionately, remembering those halcyon days where his owner understood when he was trying to warn him of danger.
Correct. That is exactly what is happening.
That's the exact takeaway that we should take from this.
Because if we look at the little sequences, like a 6-panel sequence, if we like zoom out a little bit, and this will be on the site, no worries. Like that first panel, he does speak.
Oh boy, this will taste good.
That's what he says in English. So he finds that chicken. He, you know, so there's like a 6-panel comedy sequence where he's trying to take a bite out of it, but he can't because it's frozen, and it's a losing battle. And they do it like in a little 6-panel grid in somewhere in the middle of the page, which has 11 other panels telling the story. But he does speak, except he's alone. He's not speaking to Tintin. Tintin will not respond to that. And when Tintin eventually speaks to his dog, when he notices this is happening, if we zoom out even more to the larger page, you know, poor Snowy, that's a frozen chicken. You're never going to get inside it. But it's an owner talking to a dog, knowing the dog can't really understand him, that the dog has just done something foolish that only dogs do because dogs don't understand. The dynamic really is human to animal. Whereas as a child, if you start from the beginning, you have been trained to think of Snowy as a person, as a character in his own right. So there's something kind of sad about that in a way.
But I think this seems to happen, like, of course, coming to this thought, it would take me a few moments to actually like put together the list. But I think when you have writers that write for children, they tend to evolve the characters and the maturity of the subject as they create more material for it. And I think part of what that is they're sort of calibrating. What works? What doesn't? Hey, kids obviously love his name Snowy in the book, but does he need to interact with Tintin? Do I want this book to be this young, scrappy reporter who has this wonderful dog who can talk? Or is it more about a boy and his dog, kind of the counter Annie with his friends, and they're solving mysteries and going on adventures? And he calibrated the way to say, well, taking away Snowy's ability to talk to the audience wouldn't work because suddenly he just says nothing, but nobody else has to understand him. For one, it'll be funny, but for two, the kids want to know what Snowy's thinking, because I know when I looked at my dog as a kid, I imagined full-formed sentences in their minds. you know, we were having a conversation. They just couldn't speak English, and that's why they weren't, you know, articulating anything to me. That's a recognition on Hergé's part. Like, this would work. You know, we can think of Harry Potter got more complicated as those went, you know, as that particular series went on. I'll think of some even better examples later. But compare and contrast with series that never really evolved too much. Frank Baum's work, the Oz series, good series, but it never really grew. If you compare early to late, maybe the writing's better, but I don't think the subject matter got more dense and the characters didn't get sort of, you know, more complicated. It was, you know, you read an early Oz story and you read a late Oz story and you're getting kind of the same fare and you have a good time. Tintin grew with the audience because the author was growing. And that's where I think that goes back to that idea. You can always see RJ like shining through this work.
Like, he's still catering to that child in you and giving you the dog comedy, for example. But look at this page. It begins with, they're just supposed to be a plane crash. They're in the Himalayas. Tintin has found a teddy bear. Captain Haddock, he's visibly moved. And then the dog finds the chicken. Oof, let's bring it back down. And the dog can have a comedy bit before we get back on track. So he knows, like, he's playing with that tone. It's a high wire act. Like, it's not a cheat, and it's not, like, breaking the mood to have Snowy find the chicken, because that last panel brings it back in a way. Like, we were looking at the last panel of the sequence, but when Tintin breaks in, the ultimate panel of the sequence, yeah. Snowy has a tear. Like, obviously, he's crying because he's just exerted himself. He's panting. He hasn't gotten to the chicken, so he's teary because of those reasons, but we're still maybe teary because of the previous sequence. You can see how he's massaging these moments to make it like sad, then, no, wait, don't be too sad. Let's have a little comedy. Thank you, Snowy. That's your function. And then we're back on track. We're talking to the Sherpa and going on a walk and finding a cave. And that all happens within that one page.
He's also transmitting an interesting, or not interesting, I'd say, a very important plot element. They're looking for Chang. And I have to resist yelling him out because that's the first couple of pages. That's the running joke. But that would sound terrible over the speaker. He's looking for Chang. Here's food. Oh, great. Maybe Chang has some food. No, it's frozen. So if Chang is out there and he has any food with him, what is he going to do? Snowy can't get into this chicken. He can't even penetrate the surface of it. It's frozen solid. So it's bringing the mood, you know, into a little bit of comical. And then, oh, poor Snowy, you can't eat that. It's frozen. But reminding the reader, hey, remember Chang's peril. Remember the entire point of the story. This is not just Tintin versus nature. This is also Tintin versus nature on a clock. His friend is out here. If his friend survived, what is he going to eat? He's got plenty to drink around. You can just melt snow. You just put it in your mouth. But what is he going to eat? He's starving. And if you're starving and you're in, say, like the Himalayas, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, it's very poignant. Obviously, all we were looking at was a little panel of a dog wrestling with a chicken, growling. I do love the grr that is kind of furry itself, prickly maybe. So there's a play with fonts, with lettering. Any last thoughts on this? I mean, we've gone into it pretty deep, and maybe this is our love for Hergé coming through almost more than the panel details, but any last thoughts on this little panel?
My last thought on the panel is what you just brought up on the grr. Snowy's motion, if you look at the preceding panels, is he's worrying the chicken. That's what a dog will do. They grab something and they worry it. They whip it back and forth to try to, you know, to break its neck or, you know, loosen things up. That's their hunter instinct coming out. And that's why the letters are a little fuzzy, because it's not just Snowy grr, it's also motion grr. If he was going grr, well, he's trying to warn the chicken. But I think that the furry lines there, the initial, like the impression I got is, it's to say, like, he's trying to move this thing around. So, like, when a dog has got something and he's, you know, moving it around, it's like, rawr, 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 rawr. You know, they make this little oscillation because they're moving their head as they vocalize. Whereas if they're warning somebody, they just do that low warning grr. So, again, he even managed to take, you know, the letters and add emotion to the letters, to work the lettering into the action sequence. And, like, usually the only way that you can individualize, you know, any kind of font for characters is either you bold it, maybe you do some kind of funky color to it, or you just make it bigger. Here, he did something so simple, but it adds not only context, it adds humor. It even, while you're looking at this, kind of like you're reading a story, you can start to hear the sound that the dog is making at that moment. You're like, oh, he's making that little noise when he's whipping something back and forth. How cute.
And I think we could have taken, like, the randomizer could have given us any panel in this book, and we would have gone on and on and on about it, because everything is so well thought out.
I love this man's work. And, you know, and everybody in the team. But the sense of motion, it really makes me think of Miyazaki. That same beauty of motion that comes out in character. Now, Miyazaki is the advantage of animation. But this is like the same kind of feeling I get when I'm watching a Miyazaki film, is the same kind of feeling like I get when I'm reading Tintin. I'm like, I'm looking at somebody who understands movement and depth and texture. And it just comes out in deceptively simple drawings. And, you know, as a very amateur artist myself, you know, it makes me realize how woefully underqualified I am, you know, in my own artistic endeavors. Because you look at this and you're like, this is a dozen black and white lines on a picture with a handful of colors, including blue. And he got across so much in one single panel.
Well, I think we can end it there. This love letter to Hergé and to Tintin. So thank you, Ian. I think you had fun with it.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly sounds like it. I'll let you go back to the margins. We'll listen to a short promo, and I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode.
Satyr, who's there?
Hyperion to a satyr.
Follow Siskoid's deep scene-by-scene dive into adaptations of Shakespeare's Hamlet on Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Network's Hamlet podcast. To listen or not to listen isn't the question. Kenneth Branagh, Derek Jacobi, Mel Gibson, Laurence Olivier, Ethan Hawke, David Tennant, Classics Illustrated, and many more covered every episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com or where you usually get your podcasts.
Rest is silent.
And now your feedback on our previous episode, which featured Steve Givens and a panel from Silk number 2, comment by comment. Let's start with Dr. Ange says, I was a big fan of Silk in all her volumes. I liked Stacey Lee's art and thought Tana Ford was also well-suited for the gig. I liked the teen hero learning the ropes trope in comics. I like that Silk has a bit of dark backstory, locked away for years, and that she's trying to overcome it. So the whole book worked. This is a great panel because it does have a sort of clockwise progression, which leads you back to the left side of the page and then drop down to the next set of panels. And Lee's manga style works for the action and the character. Great discussion. I like Silk enough to have brought a bunch of issues to cons to get signed, including this very one, signed by cover artist Dave Johnson and Stacey Lee. Paul Keane says, great discussion. Love the construction of that panel. And Mike Thomas says, great episode. I always enjoy this podcast. I like the idea of the randomizer. Great, Mike. You'll find it now on the Who's Who podcast. They're using it for their new Who's Who review. And it sounds much better than mine. I'm so jealous. Anyway, he goes on. He says, it's fun finding out what year and comic book you'll be delving into. And then when you give some broader context to the panel as well. Well, thank you for all those comments. Before we go, we have to mention the Fire and Water Podcast Network Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. If you like this content, please think about making a one-time or a monthly donation to help host all of the podcasts on the network. And as ever, a reminder that if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line. We'll arrange it. You'll be handed a comic book panel randomly, and we'll put it up for discussion. My thanks again to my guest, Ian Fletcher. And until we refill that seat, the panel is open.